Welcome, Al. We look forward to about the next 45 minutes of time we'll spend together. We'll get into some questioning. Before we do that, though, I welcome you to make a brief opening statement. And as we near the end of our time, I will try to give you a heads up that we're on the last question or two, and then also at the end you can give a closing statement if you'd like.
Okay.
So please, as much as you can, just try to speak into the microphone if possible.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you all for serving on the RCAC. It's, appreciate the time and effort that you put into this and what you do for the university and for the state. It's an important mission. So I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I grew up in Northeast Minneapolis. I went to Minneapolis Edison High School. I started the university in 1966, and 1967 I joined the Navy. I was a photographer's. I got to be a photographer's mate, second class, while I was in. I served on an aircraft carrier for 2 years and did one combat tour in Vietnam. Back to the U in 1971, worked on the Minnesota Daily. I almost graduated in 1975. I had been offered a job up in Hibbing, and I said, well, I'll be up in a week. I have to get my finals and taken care of, and then I'll be done. And the editor said, well, we'd really like you to start Monday. And I said, no, I have to do my finals next week. And he said, we'd really like you to start Monday. And it was in those days where you didn't need the piece of paper. You only needed the education. That was our part of that cultural ethos in those days. So I left without getting my degree, and I started as a reporter at the Hibbing Daily Tribune in 1975. And a year later, the editor who hired me died, and they looked around and they hired me to be the editor. So I spent the next 18 years as the editor of the Hibbing Daily Tribune. In 1991, during that time, I went back and got my degree, and which was good. My father had never made it past eighth grade, and he was so proud that both of his sons got degrees from the University of Minnesota. And so I managed to get it before he died, and that was a good thing. 93, I left the Hibbing Daily Tribune. I started my own business for a couple of years, kind of a communications business. And 1995, I started working for the American Legion. My title is communications director. The biggest part of my job is to produce a newspaper for the members. It has 87,000 circulation right now, and it's actually the third largest newspaper in the state by circulation. And then in 2007 I went back and got my master's in liberal studies at the U. I'm married. I have six children, and as things go around, my youngest daughter, who's 17, recently applied for admission to the University of Minnesota. So, I've served on a bunch of volunteer groups, especially in Hibbing. When you're in a small town, they always want the editor to be on everything. So I was on everything, and Rotary and Chamber and things like that. Since then, I've served on the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Mass Communication Alumni Board for a few years. I served on the Minnesota News Council until it folded last year. And I served on the State Board of Education for 7 years. Not too long after I left the State Board, the legislature disbanded that. So if you're seeing a pattern here. While I was on the State Board of Education, I chaired what was called the Special Populations Committee for 6 years. It was a committee that spent its time looking at issues involving students of color, disabled students. We had direct oversight over the academies for the deaf and the academy for the blind in Faribault. I'm kind of following the list that I was given of topics here. And the next one was fiduciary responsibility. And I have to admit that if you talk to journalists, you'll find that a lot of them got into journalism because they saw there was no math component involved. But I've spent years and years covering city councils and school boards and things like that. I can read and understand financial reports. And in addition, I am also the manager of my newspaper, and it's about a $350,000 business that I have to run each year and do the budgeting for and try to keep it afloat. We don't, if we're a nonprofit, we don't try to make money, but we also can't go broke. I can tell you more about that later if you're interested. The next item was leadership, role, and responsibility. Well, I guess I'd hearken back to my days on the State Board of Education. I know how a state board works. I know it has to work with the legislature. If it doesn't work with the legislature will disband it. I don't think that's a danger with the Board of Regents, but if you don't get it, you have to work with the legislature. And the purpose of a board, of course, is to provide policy, not management. As an individual regent, I was just looking that over this morning, A through P, so there's a whole bunch of responsibilities of an individual regent, and I think I'd sum it up, just say, you know, wherever you go, you're representing the University of Minnesota. You are, for myself, I've probably attended in my 20 years in giving, and since then, you know, 5,000 meetings. What I've become is a gatherer of information, like most journalists, and I've tried to develop my listening skills, and then just a little side, I suppose you have to, as a regent, you have to watch out for those conflicts of interest. I've been reading about that. So why me? Why would I make a good regent? I guess I look at it as that I'm kind of a living, breathing University of Minnesota success story. And when I started the university in 1966, I really didn't have anything going for me except potential. My family didn't have any money. They never paid a dime of my tuition. I have no family history of anybody, you know, getting a university degree. And so the university was there when I needed it, and it was affordable. I had GI Bill, of course, but, I worked my way through the university, basically. Since then, I've edited two really good newspapers. The Minnesota Legionnaire we have a national organization in the American Legion and of newspapers, and my newspaper has been voted the best Legion newspaper in the United States in 12 out of the last 16 years. So I'm proud of my accomplishments with those two newspapers. I've in the last 12 years or so, I've written 5 books. 4 of them basically preserve military history of Minnesota veterans. I kind of fell into that niche because of my work on the Minnesota Legionnaire. I had to find out some way that to make people read the newspaper, and I found out that feature stories about veterans really helped. And And so I started writing these stories, and then we gathered them into these books. The first book was a fundraiser for the World War II Memorial at the Capitol, right over here. And we raised $70,000 for that through that book. The second book raises money for Asian youth programs like baseball and Boy State and Girl State. So I've served on a bunch of boards and committees, and I've lived in the big city and small city, and now I live in the burbs, and and then the last question on that thing was, you know, what? How would you deem it a success after 6 years? And I guess if I could see that the University of Minnesota is still helping people like me achieve their dreams and their goals, helping people become successful citizens and contributors to the state. You know, and of course the big balance is quality education balanced by affordable education, and that's a tough balancing act. But I think that should be the region's number one priority, and I think it can be done. And that's my opening statement.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Lois.
Besides helping individuals move forward, the university is critical to the state's economy moving forward. Would you talk with us, please, from the vantage point of having lived in Greater Minnesota and having attended 5,000 meetings and having covered issues for one or definitely potentially two and definitely one paper that covers the entire state, how you see the University of Minnesota being able to be an enhanced economic driver for the state, and perchance what you would bring to that effort. So, in general, how you would see the university be an enhanced economic driver for the state, and then what you individually might potentially bring to that effort as a regent?
Well, I think the university does that in a number of ways. Of course, through research and things like that, you know, the university can provide, create jobs, create industries, create ways of doing things that and has done that, you know, very successfully through the years. The other way is to make sure that the younger people or older people coming up in Minnesota that need the education to make them productive and make them a part of that economy are able to get it. I was just reading actually talking to somebody that's from Wyoming. And Wyoming, the University of Wyoming is absolutely free to anybody who lives in Wyoming. No, I don't, you know, it's probably not going to be possible in Minnesota, but it gives you an indicator of how important they feel it is for their citizens to be able to have access to that kind of higher education. And I think we need to have that same commitment. You know, we can't give it away, but we can make it affordable, make it realistic for people to attend the University of Minnesota. And I know since my time, the state college system has grown up a lot. You know, and has become a player in the same roles that you're talking about. And I realize that, but I think the University of Minnesota can still be the leader in that. And, you know, as a region, I would just, you know, I push towards those ideals. You know, I don't have insight into what the regions have been doing for ever. And, you know, all I can say is that once I get there, I would apply these modest skills I have toward learning that. But what I can bring is that commitment, you know, to education.
Al, I want to thank you for your military service. Being on an aircraft carrier in Southeast Asia is a little different than my 6 months at Fort Leonard Wood. The military and the American Legion and returning veterans, do you have some thoughts about how the university, knowing how robust a part of the state is, how it might be able to reach out to this very important community that can help our state and grow the economy, kind of following up on what Lois Josephson was just asking about?
I think reaching out is really a key phrase in this whole thing. There are, thanks to the Vietnam veterans, basically, when the Vietnam veterans came home, and there's this myth that's grown up that we walk through airports and people spit on us and things like that. Well, I never encountered anything like that. I was always treated well as a veteran. And when I came home and when I wore my uniform, you know, in public places and things like that. But there was a problem with there weren't a lot of programs out there for returning veterans. A lot of combat veterans coming back had, you know, problems with, you know, in World War One they called it shell shock, in World War Two they called it battle fatigue, and finally, and they're starting to clue in by the time Vietnam came around, they realize that a lot of men and women come home with some pretty serious problems, and they need help. They need you know, lots of help. And so the Vietnam veterans have been in the forefront of pushing for a lot of benefits for the soldiers that are coming home now. And there are a lot of benefits out there for them, more than any soldier ever, you know, coming home from any war in any nation has ever seen. And Minnesota is in the forefront of that. We really, thanks to Governor Pawlenty, I think, pushed a lot of these programs through. So the programs are there. The problem is that reaching out part. And so many of these soldiers come home and they are coached and told and everything else to, you know, they have 30-day programs, 60-day programs, 90-day programs. You know, they're trying to keep these men and women in the system and try to help them. But especially if they have some PTSD or other problems, that kind of tends to separate them out a little bit and makes it a little harder for them to access some of the programs. So it's what the university needs is to make sure that any veteran that comes here gets, you know, is latched onto and gets some good counseling and good help and things like that. The programs are all there. It's just a matter of making sure that they can get at them, that you know, if they have come home with and they're fighting some things, that they can, you know, work through that as they work through their university career. It's the one thing us Vietnam guys, you know, probably did right, was to make sure that, you know, the new generation had, you know, had an opportunity. And these are, you know, incredibly motivated people in most cases, and their work habits are amazing, and they're good people to educate and be part of our future of our state.
Yep.
I think you've already probably covered this. Paul asked the question, but I was privileged to go over with the governor to Kosovo to visit our troops, and last February went to Kuwait to visit the troops there and serve a steak dinner to them as well. The commanding officer over there was Colonel Kurska, who happens to be a battalion chief in our fire department. But so I wanted to just ask, and maybe I think you've touched on it, but what maybe specifically can the university do to encourage, not only encourage, but to accommodate these men and women that are coming home to actually get into school and get a degree? We're working on getting them jobs too, but also their education.
Well, the main thing is that if I was a soldier coming home, I think I had some help along the way. With county veteran service officers, and the county veteran service officer is kind of where the rubber meets the road for veterans getting and understanding their benefits, because benefits are extremely, because they're created by the government, they are extremely complicated and hard to understand. And I had a story here. I was clipping some stories over the past couple of weeks about university, and one of the stories is how GIs coming home don't understand how to use the GI Bill. So I guess to answer your question, if I was coming into the university, I would want somebody to grab hold of me and make sure I knew what was going on and that I could access these benefits and understand them. And there are people that the state pays for to do this. I'm not sure how well they're doing. I'm just not sure. I'm just not sure. I don't know, how that's going on. Not just on the University of Minnesota, but on state colleges, and that help is supposed to be there. My question would be, how well trained is that help? How aggressive is it? The CVSOs will spend years in training before they really know all these programs and benefits and things like that. And I'm a little afraid that student slash advisor, because it's usually somebody that's going to the U that is a counselor to these guys. And do they have the time? Do they have the expertise? Do they have the motivation? So, it's something we need to keep looking at. I say we, but it's something that everybody needs to keep looking at.
Thank you.
Joanne.
You said you've been clipping articles about the University of Minnesota.
Sure.
And there were several recent articles in the New York Times, our local paper. You're a sitting regent, and you open up and you read the article. How do you respond to that? What do you do?
The one this morning, of course, was about the couple from that was
Georgia Tech.
Georgia, and they were double dipping and collecting salaries from the University of Minnesota. That's not a real positive for the University of Minnesota. In a previous life back in Hibbing, I knew John Finnegan a little bit. He was a friend of mine, and I actually helped him with a paper he was writing one time. He's the guy that hired one of these people. Anyway, as a regent, once the cat's out of the bag or the cow's out of the barn or whatever, before you want to use it, there's not much you can do anymore. I guess what a region has to do is to be smart enough to see this stuff coming or be well informed enough through the administration to know what's coming. But I think there's some, you know, I don't know about this one this morning, the biggest black eye the university's gotten, in my opinion, in the last 6 months or so, or a year or so, is paying another university $800,000 so we don't have to play a football game. And I don't know how, you know, what exactly how the regents were involved in that, but if at all. But it's one of those common sense things, you know, that if you're sitting on a regents board, and sometimes this stuff in the ivory tower can get lost, but if there's somebody sitting on a board that can say, wait a minute, you know, it's not really a good idea to, you know, pay $800,000 so we don't have to play a football game. You know, it's just not going to, you know, it's not going to be, it's not a good financial decision. It's also not going to go over very well with the public. And, you know, so I think that's where a regent can, you know, maybe if they're well informed enough, they can, you know, make a common sense suggestion anyway to the administration. I don't believe in any way in micromanaging or trying to interfere with but the policy issues that and things that the regents do deal with. Like I say, you know, as far as these stories in the newspaper, I suppose it's the duty of the regent to, and I see that only one regent is allowed to speak to the public, and that's the chairman. So it's not like, which is different from the State Board of Education. We were talking all the time to, you know, anybody that asked us. Maybe that's why it's not around anymore. but since there's only, it's not like the regents can go out and do a publicity campaign and say this is all right, or, you know, or try to explain. You know, there's only one spokesman. So anyway, I don't know if I've answered your question, but there's not much you can do once the event has happened, I guess. And it seems that, you know, in newspapers, it's usually bad news. And as a newspaper man, I understand that. You know, it's good news is doesn't make the front page.
I have a question. So what should be the story out there for the University of Minnesota?
Sir?
What should be our story?
Well, it's interesting. You know, that's a big question. The big story that reaches most of the public is that the University of Minnesota basketball team is rated eighth in the country. You know, that's most people's connection to the university is through sports, and that's positive. That can be very positive. You know, it can also be I watch too much sports, and I'm able to sit back and see that sports is a time waster in some ways, I don't know. But we do stay connected to the university through sports. I was getting a prescription filled in the pharmacy, and I happened to be wearing some Gopher gear, and as he filled my prescription, there ensued a 5-minute conversation about the Minnesota Gophers' upcoming basketball schedule, and we both were, of course, very informed and talked very smart about it. You know, but I mean, it's just how people connect in Minnesota is through the sports. So now, push all that aside. You know, it's the elephant. You know, that you can't ignore. That's how most people perceive the university is through sports. I think what people, the big story should be is what you see on the 1-minute commercials they have during the sports things that kind of promote the university, the research, kids succeeding, you know, putting people into our state's culture and economy that are ready to contribute and you know, have a splendid education behind them. a leader in the kind of the central core of intellectual or thinking and leadership. You know, that's what the university should be. It should, you know, when people think of the university, it should be, I'm really proud of that university and what it's done over the years and what it's produced and the tremendous individuals that it's produced and I can, you know, when I was going through the School of Journalism, there were people like Harrison Salisbury and Max Schulman and dozens of others that were Harry Reisner, you know, the Eric Severide, you know, all these people had gone through the university, and it really gave you something to shoot for, you know, and to be proud of, and that's what, you know, the people should be proud of the University of Minnesota. And there's always going to be stories, you know, but there should be enough wherewithal to carry on.
A little different tact. I'm sure you, over many years in the journalism business, have seen major changes from the way that you collect information, the way that you publish the information, referring to the changes in technology and in the media. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your experience in doing that. And secondarily, how does that sort of information fit into your role as a regent and a governing body for the university?
Is the changing technology, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been interesting just in the last year for me because when Facebook first came out, I was kind of interested in it. And then I talked to my son, who was about 26 or 27 at the time. He said, "Dad, don't even go near it. It's a waste of your time, and, you know, don't bother with it." And so, not wanting to in the first place, I took his advice, and I kind of stayed away from it. But as an organization, the American Legion is trying to recruit younger members. And so all us old fogies have to get with it, and especially those of us who are in leadership positions. So we started our own Facebook page at the Legion. And in order to do that, if you're going to be an administrator to this corporate Facebook page, I had to start my own personal Facebook page. It's a requirement. And I had to find 5 friends, which I thought would be hard, but I did. And actually, that isn't hard. You know, they just every day somebody wants to be my friend, and I'm a little suspicious of that. So that's just, you know, one example. In my lifetime, when I started working at the Hibbing Daily Tribune, we typed our stories on Underwood typewriters, you know, these big ones. They weighed about 100 pounds, and I loved it because you could just hammer away at those things. And we were the first business in town to computerize. In 1978, the Hibbing Daily Tribune went to computers. You find another business that went to computers in 1978. So there was very little training, and we fought our way through it. And then when I came to the American Legion, they were still publishing the newspaper, which was one of the reasons it was losing money every year, kind of the old-fashioned way. And what I did was there's no computer in my office. I had to bring my computer from home and run my office with my home computer until they finally bought me one. But I started desktop publishing, you know, so I do the whole newspaper, you know, in that way. From beginning to end, every word that's in the newspaper, you know, every wonderful thing and every mistake is all mine, you know. So, which, of course, when I was in Hibbing, there were like 40 people that did that job. You know, 40 people gathered every day to make this newspaper, and now I do it all by myself. You know, I think the question really isn't about technology. It's about how the world is changing, and that last little part of it is, you know, how we can. We are all our own publishers, and we're all our own. There's a commercial on TV where kids are running around with cameras and capturing pictures, and they put them up on. You know, that's what we have to deal with. Is that the whole human race, and especially, you know, here in the United States, is going through a terrific change these days. I'm signed up for a course. I finished my master's program, but I still want to take some master's courses, and I'm signed up for a course that'll start in 2 weeks. That's on it's called the threshold or something like that, and it's that we are on a threshold of change, and we have been, of course. I mean, we have been since 1776, but you know, this new threshold of change is has so much to do with this technology and how we can interact and communicate, and there's good things to that. I was sitting with my son the other day watching a Gopher basketball game, and I said, "Yeah, I wonder how many points he scored in the other game." My son went on his phone, and he had the answer. I mean, the information is just so absolutely accessible these days. But there's some downside to it. De Tocqueville said that the success of America was based on the associations that we had together and how we worked together to accomplish things. And people don't join anything anymore. You know, they connect through technology, and they don't actually get together as groups anymore. The Rotary clubs are failing. The American Legion is failing. The churches are getting smaller, except for those churches that rely heavily on technology. That's a really big question, but you know, I'm stumbling with it. But technology is, you know. You got to stay up with it, but you also, I think, we need to have, you know, a little bigger view of, you know, what's happening.
Margaret?
The regent position at the University of Minnesota is probably one of the most important governance positions in the state. Now, you've worked in a lot of organizations, nonprofit organizations, where you needed to govern. Can you give us an example? What was your most significant personal contribution to something that was a crossroads in one of those organizations? And then the flip side of it, can you give us an example of where a governance situation you led didn't work and you'd like to rewind the video?
I used two examples, both from the State Board of Education, and sneak up to the microphone. The one that worked, and you said where I was the...
Yes, I want you as a point person here, not a story about somebody else.
Well, all I can say is that we worked as a team, and I had a lot of input in this. But to say it was me would be difficult, and I think, you know, as a regent, I think it would be difficult to say I was the guy that, you know, because it should work as a team. But I was there was in Minnesota in the late 90s, in the late 80s, there were still dozens of schools, high schools, that had nicknames and mascots that were offensive to parts of our population, mainly the Indian community. And the State Board of Education, of course, had rulemaking, but we decided, I decided, no, it's not,
no but, that,
you, but, you, but we decided that this wasn't a really... this was an educational opportunity for these communities. It was going to be very difficult in these communities to change. I know Grand Rapids, which is just down the road from Hibbing, you know, the Grand Rapids Indians. And during the games, they had a kid that wore a full war bonnet, you know, running around the court or the hockey rink or whatever. You know, this was part of their culture, and it was going to be very difficult to give up. And we knew that the only way this could be done successfully in these 20 or 30 different towns in Minnesota is if it was done voluntarily and if it was done with done locally. You know, they had to debate it themselves. They had to talk it over, and they had to come to a decision and feel good about what they were doing. And so that's how we approach it. We wrote a letter to every school in the state, and every one that we thought had a name that had potential for this, and that in itself becomes a problem, because is warrior, you know, there's Greek warriors, and you know, is warrior, maybe warrior is not a good name in any case, but is warrior, you know, is that offensive to anybody? But we sent letters out. We talked. On the State Board of Education, we often ended up speaking to, you know, groups, schools here and there, commencement kind of things. We spoke about it a lot. And then within 3 years, without passing a rule, I would say 95% of those schools had changed. And then there was a slow, you know, it's still going on. North Dakota is still, I don't know where they're at right now, but they're still fighting, you know. Some of them are still fighting that. The not success story was something called outcome-based education. We were like the university, and I saw one of the stories I saw was the university needs to have more business people on the Board of Regents, because evidently the university doesn't understand the business community in Minnesota, and they needed more of that kind of input. Well, the Board of Education at that time was also getting a lot of input from the business community, and that we were turning out students that weren't ready for the workforce. And so the result of that was this thing called outcome-based education, where kids had to prove, you know, that they in the various areas, you know, that they had achieved achieved a certain level of accomplishment or success. There was a saying on the state board at that time that it's hard to change the education system. Changing the education system is like trying to change a graveyard. You don't get a lot of internal support. And there is a fact that teachers don't like, you know, they're professionals. They you know, they like what they do. They're proud of what they do. They don't want to change their whole system around. So it was the board trying to impose this, the board being pushed by the business community, trying to impose this new form of education on the whole state, and in the meantime, the legislature is just kind of going, you know, what are they doing, or, you know, what's going on? You know, and some, a lot of legislators supported us, a lot of them didn't. So I think outcome-based education was a reason that there is no State Board of Education anymore. You know, it was a well-intentioned effort that didn't, as opposed to the other one, it didn't include the people who were doing the hard work, and you know, what should have been done is we have this problem where we're preparing, and you know, this is ongoing in Minnesota. You know, there's stories. You know, there's still with these tests, and they don't know if they're good enough, or you know, but the problem should be brought to the people who are involved in it should be brought to the teachers. and then find the solutions through them. The problem shouldn't be imposed by us, who have a great idea, you know, that's supposedly going to solve this problem. And it just didn't go over. There was never any acceptance. There was never any ownership of the idea, and it was a disaster.
Mr. Zidane, we've got several more questions, but unfortunately we're out of time.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So I apologize. I meant to give you notice that we were getting near the end, but we are at the end. So at this, I would welcome a closing statement.
The only thing I'd like to ask,
as a journalist, and you ask a lot of people questions, if there's anything that you would have a suggestion of a question you would have expected us to ask of you.
No, I thought the questions were good. I hope my answers were good, but the questions were very good. The only thing I would want to say is, this is kind of my little rehearsed part of the. But there were two brothers that came over from Poland around 1900. They came from a small town and they worked in a flour mill, and they naturally migrated to Minneapolis, where the flour mills were, and they worked in the Pillsbury A mill. They both died young, probably from breathing flour dust and things like that. The OSHA wasn't around in those days. But they had a lot of children. And so that was my dad's generation. And they became sanitation workers, bus drivers, carpenters. My dad worked for the Minneapolis Brewing Company and made Greenbelt beer. Their children, and none of them, of course, ever, you know, went close to the university. You know, it just wasn't part of their dream, part of their expectations. Their children, my cousin Larry works for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to make sure that your streams and rivers are pristine and clean. My cousin Jim is a city planner for the city of St. Paul. Cousin Anna owns a major art gallery in Minneapolis. My cousin, my brother Joe, is a chief financial officer for a Fortune 500 company. All with University of Minnesota degrees, and that's what the university can do. That's what it has to do. And not, you know, now there's a whole new group of immigrants and third generation, second generation people that. But just people in general, and that would be my goal, to make sure that the university never loses sight of that opportunity to elevate people within the state and help them find their dreams. That's it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.